A theme among many Democratic candidates in this primary is bridging the divide between parties and bringing the American people together. How do you plan to accomplish that?
I think the most important thing any public servant can do is listen. Find out what are the worries and fears and anxieties of the families you hope to represent, and then find bipartisan solutions to solve their problems. That's what I do every day in the Senate. It's why I was able to pass 18 bills last Congress. And these were bills that I wrote and passed because I heard of concerns from my constituents and found Republicans who had constituents with the same concerns. So it's not hard to do. You just have to start by listening and then building common ground. And the areas where most people want us to focus on is healthcare as a right and not a privilege, fixing our public schools, making college more affordable, helping people get higher paying jobs so they can provide for their kids. It's really that simple.
So if there are so many bipartisan So if there are so many people in Congress that are willing to be looking in that compromise and in that direction, why aren't we hearing more about that?
I think a lot of times politics gets reduced to us against them and gets reduced to an argument about who's right about this, that, or the other thing. But that's really not it. What politics should be about is public service. We are servants first. It means you put others before yourself, and it means you try to make people's lives better, that you're supposed to help people. And so if you find other senators who have that same perspective, you can get pretty much anything done. And that's why we passed, you know, in my 10 years, a lot of bills that really do help people, like the 9/11 health bill. The fact that men and women answered the call of duty and raced up towers when people were running down. The fact that more firefighters have died since 9/11 than on 9/11 because of all the toxins they breathed in and all the cancers, that's something we can all do something about. And it's why we were able to write a bill and finally pass a bill where we got their health care done unanimously.
You're in the frap machine in there, I guess?
Yeah.
Particularly in New Hampshire, voters who are familiar with your record most likely associate you with advocacy for a national family leave program. You've introduced legislation in Congress and family and medical leave every year since 2013, but so far it's been unsuccessful. If you've been unable to persuade your colleagues to deal with that issue up to now, that enjoys fairly widespread bipartisan support, you know, why should voters expect you to deliver as president?
Well, some issues you need to drive the advocacy over many years. When I repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I was able to do that because state by state, advocates were working on marriage equality. In my own state, we had had a vote on marriage equality, and it had failed. But after we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was the very discriminatory policy that told men and women who were serving in the military that they couldn't, based on who they love, something so, you know, discriminatory and corrosive. After we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the next time we voted on marriage equality in New York, it passed. So sometimes you have to build on successes and failures to get to move forward. And I think paid leave is exactly that. I think we're having a national conversation right now about, do we value women? Do we want women and families to thrive in America? Do we want caregivers to thrive in America? Do we want to change the workplace rules to reflect the actual face of the workforce? And that's what the paid leave debate's about. And it makes such economic sense.
Well, and Republicans in some way do agree with you. They're increasingly, you know, in support of their own version. How do you think that would affect...
I think it's great. I mean, the fact, when I started this advocacy 6 years ago, my goal was just to get it debated on the presidential stage. Sure enough, we got it debated. Both Hillary and Bernie had proposals. Trump had a proposal. Marco Rubio had a proposal to have four presidential candidates debate what's the best way to have paid leave. To me, was complete success. And so now we've got actually legislative proposals from Republicans. The one area of common ground that I've just found that I think is terrific is the fact that the Republicans who are proposing it are suggesting that they want caregivers to be able to draw down on Social Security. Where the common ground lies is they believe, therefore, that paid leave should be an earned benefit. I believe that we need to buy in as an earned benefit at 0.2% of our income to add to Social Security, not to take away from. And I think if they're already there, that it's appropriate to have it funded through an earned benefit. We're halfway to compromise. And so I hopefully can persuade a Republican in this Congress to lead on this issue and to find that the way we've structured it really does make the most sense.
You've said in the past that you're embarrassed by your previous position on gun rights. While serving as a congresswoman in a rural district of New York, you received an A rating from NRA. Now, you've since changed your stance on the issue since you were elected statewide. Is it fair for voters to see that change in position as a political calculation?
No, I think it was one of the most heartfelt decisions I made. When I met families who lost their loved ones to gun violence, when I met the parents of Nyasia Pryor Yard, a high school girl who was with her friends when a stray bullet killed her, I met all her classmates. And that was 10 years ago. And when I met that family and those classmates, I just realized instantaneously that I should have been a better leader. I should have cared about communities outside of my own where we didn't experience the same gun violence that Buffalo does, or the Bronx, or Brooklyn. But I still should have cared about those families just as much and maybe led my district on that issue. I should have asked and demanded to be stronger on that issue and to really lead on it, and I didn't. So I regret it. I think it was a lack of strength and a lack of humility to know that you need to care for everybody, even if it's not in your backyard and even if it's not the constituents that you're representing, that you actually do need to care about everyone. And I should have been stronger and better.
Do you see it more as a states' rights issues, though?
You know, I didn't. It is a states' rights issue for a lot of people. But for me, I really was just focused on the priorities that I was representing my district on, and that wasn't among them. It doesn't matter. When people are dying around this country, you need to protect their families too. And that's why I think I'm a great candidate for president, because I can go to red and purple places that deeply believe in the Second Amendment, that, you know, really admire and support hunting rights. You know, my mother still, you know, when she's hunting, she does shoot the Thanksgiving turkey. So I understand the importance of hunting. But I would go to those red and purple places and say, yes, but you also do care about a four-year-old losing his life on a park bench in Brooklyn, and we all care about that. So let's actually make sure that guns don't get in the hands of criminals. Let's actually make sure no one can buy a gun who is on the terror watch list. Let's make sure someone with a violent criminal background can't get access to a weapon. I think it's an outrage that the NRA is as greed-driven as it is. The fact that they are even opposing the Violence Against Women's Act because they think there's going to be some man who has a violent streak against his wife should be able to buy a gun if he wants to kill her. I mean, that's just outrageous and absurd that they have to sink so low. And it really means to me they care about gun sales more than they do people. And that's the definition of greed.
Voters here in New Hampshire have already heard a lot of talk from Democrats in this race about fundamental changes to democracy. I mean, lowering the voting age, scrapping the Electoral College, among others. How necessary do you think that kind of change is at this point?
Well, I've talked to a lot of voters around the country that, like me, believe that it should be one person, one vote. And it just doesn't make sense that there's such a disconnect between the Electoral College outcome and the actual vote. And so I think it's something we as Americans should actually have a national debate about whether we need the Electoral College anymore, and that shouldn't it actually be one person, one vote.
Do you feel that the country as a whole, though, is going in that direction, or do you feel that that is a kind of a far-left issue at this point?
I don't see it as a far-left issue. I think it's an issue that we should debate. I think we should talk about it with the American people, because if you're going to do something that significant, you need to make sure the American people are behind you. So I think it's an issue we should talk about.
So it's an open question at this point in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, I have a preference for one person, one vote, so I'm lean on the side of getting rid of it. But I'd love to talk about it with voters and hear what they think.
You've also changed your position in the past on immigration. While serving as a congresswoman, you were against amnesty in sanctuary cities for undocumented immigrants. I want to ask you what explains your change on the issue.
So again, this was an area where I was really focused on the priorities of my own district. But I believe that immigration has always been a strength of this country. I think diversity is a strength. And if you look at our history, you know, this country was in part built by immigrants. And I think it's important to know that immigration often results in a lot of entrepreneurialism and innovation and ideas and growth in cities. We see it in New York City. We see it in small towns in upstate New York, where we've taken refugee populations, people who need our help, and we've allowed families to come, and they thrive. They start businesses. They take houses that have been long abandoned and fix them up and live in them and create thriving neighborhoods. So I think what President Trump is doing on immigration is morally wrong. I think what he's done with regard to ICE is very problematic. I think Democrats are very much in favor of border security. We've never been afraid to fund border security. And I think the anti-terrorism work we do and the efforts to stop human trafficking and drug trafficking, gun trafficking is important, and that should be fully funded. But the work he's doing to enforce and remove immigrants from this country and tear families and children apart at the border, I think is immoral. And all of that function should go away from ICE, because I don't think that is Homeland Security related and should be actually placed into the Department of Justice. Because immigration in those instances are about asylum, about family reunification, and about opportunity. And we should have real immigration judges to decide those cases. And people seeking asylum should be given access to lawyers.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.